please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Brazilian Amazon released nearly 20% more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere over the last decade than it absorbed, according to a stunning report that shows humanity can no longer depend on the world's largest tropical forest to help absorb man-made carbon pollution. From 2010 through 2019, Brazil's Amazon basin gave off 16.6 billion tons of CO2, while drawing down only 13.9 billion tons, researchers reported recently in the journal Nature Climate Change. Dear listeners, we have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Matthew Rosa, news writer. This article is published under the heading, Brazilian Amazon is now releasing more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A recent study published in the journal Nature Climate Change found that the Brazilian Amazon released roughly 20% more carbon dioxide than it absorbed during 2010s. More specifically, the rainforest absorbed 13.9 metric tons of carbon dioxide between 2010 and 2019, but released 16.6 billion metric tons during that same period. To put that in context, human fossil fuel combustion is believed to produce around 35 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. The study looked at the volume of CO2 absorbed and stored as the forest grows versus the amounts released back into the atmosphere as it has been burned down or destroyed. The authors point to poor land management policies like forest degradation as well as deforestation as causes. Notably, deforestation of the Amazon has greatly increased during the reign of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. But forest degradation, as the authors write, is the primary culprit in terms of making the rainforest a carbon fount. Forest degradation happens when a forest's biological diversity and wealth is permanently diminished. Indeed, forest degradation contributed 73% of the gross biomass loss of the Amazon, compared to deforestation, which contributed 27% of that loss. Forest degradation has become the largest process driving carbon loss and should become a higher policy priority, the authors write. Rainforests have been called the lungs of the earth and play a major role in the global carbon cycle. That the Amazon rainforest would become a net emitter of carbon was not entirely surprising given trends, however. We have expected it, but it is the first time that we have figures showing that the Brazilian Amazon has flipped and is now a net emitter. Jean-Pierre Wingerton, a co-author of the paper, told Agence France-Presse in a statement. Wingerton added, we don't know at what point the changeover could become irreversible. Rainforests are not always carbon emitters, In 2009, scientists at the Climate Congress in Copenhagen, Denmark, warned that rising temperatures and droughts could transform tropical forests into being carbon emitters rather than carbon sinks, as they were thought to have been previously. At the time, there was some hope that the world's forests might rise to the occasion and sop up the excess carbon dioxide caused by human industrial activity. Now, that seems to not be the case, and the Climate Congress warning proved to be prophetic. This is the latest bit of bad news in a series of recent reports which raise red flags about how human industrial activity is changing the planet's atmosphere on a mass scale. In September, the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, revealed that there has been a 68% decline in the population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish since 1970. Scientists at McGill University revealed last year that the threshold for dangerous global warming is likely to be reached between 2027 and 2042. Similarly, the World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that roughly 250,000 people will die annually because of factors related to climate change, scientists between 2030 and 2050. Using new methods of analyzing satellite data developed at the University of Oklahoma, their national team of researchers showed for the first time that degraded forests were a more significant source of planet warming CO2 emissions than outright deforestation. Over the same 10-year period, degradation caused by fragmentation, selective cutting, or fires that damage but do not destroy trees caused three times more emissions than outright destruction of forests. Finally, a study published last month revealed that human beings have not significantly reduced the amount of land we inhabit over the past 12,000 years, strongly suggesting that it is poor management of resources rather than the loss of wildlands which is causing climate change.
Israel's occupation of Palestine and the plight of Palestinians have once again come into focus globally as people worldwide mark the International Quds Day. Every year, on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan, pro-Palestinian groups from all faiths show solidarity with those affected by the occupation. The issue of Palestine is today recognized as one of the most complicated crises that seems far from any kind of resolution. But when did it all begin? The mass displacement of Palestinians from their ancestral lands mainly dates back to May 14, 1948, when Israel was created in Palestine and immediately recognized by the United States. Palestine had been under British colonial control until May that year. Britain had long encouraged Zionist Jews to come to Palestine. The 1948 Declaration of Independence is widely considered as the starting point for an occupation that has triggered many wars and impacted the whole Middle East and the world. Soon after the creation of Israel, the forced displacement of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, or catastrophe, began. Several hundred Palestinian villages were razed to the ground, and their residents were forced to flee and were never allowed to return. Today, the refugees and their descendants around the world number 5 million. Israel has been seizing more Palestinian lands over the past decades and keeps building on them. What's now left for the Palestinians is a tiny fraction of their original homeland. This map shows how Palestinian territories have been shrinking over the past decades. The Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights are many. To Israeli authorities, Palestinian lives don't matter at all. The Israeli regime does not hesitate to kill. Meanwhile, the regime has engaged in demographic engineering, discrimination in access to education, healthcare, and building rights. Just days ago, leading international rights group Human Rights Watch issued a report condemning Israel for committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2017, the UN Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia issued a damning report on Israeli practices in occupied Palestinian territories. The report said Israel has established an apartheid regime that oppresses the Palestinians as a whole. But for Israel, such reports and repeated UN resolutions are no big concern, as the regime has full U.S. diplomatic cover. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been let down by some Arab states. Last year, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan recognized Israel and normalized their ties with the regime. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, it is hoped that resistance and popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Raising awareness, circulating these things on social media, holding your politicians accountable, also bring the campaign aid. I mean, help people in Palestine. You know, everybody can reach out to somebody in Palestine and let them videotape the scenario around them. Like, you know, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, we always have campaign aids in Gaza. And, you know, when they get us video coverage of the houses inside and how they're living in their neighborhoods, this already by itself shows how this blockade and this occupation has treated these people and what status they're at right now. They're living in poverty. They're living in the worst conditions. And this is because of the occupation, nothing else.
American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believed none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called the superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podaritz, a son-in-law of Norman Podaritz and Mitch Decker, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the new American century. PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held the highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason, they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But this, the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers, they're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests, for this interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. Its now decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state, which support forever wars, as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America, America's interests, you're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest, these are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military-industrial complex that profits from wars, that's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue its wars and its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it. Any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, as how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, but she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating it, it's conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently being grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown. Remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think what I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? What I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end interest, and that interest is in the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, who was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem, for the United States at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. One of the goals of fasting is to attain God's proximity, but this does not mean to be isolated from the society. As a matter of fact, fasting has both individual and social impacts. According to the statistics of relevant organizations, the rate of social crimes decreases notably in all Islamic countries during the blessed month of Ramadan. Thus, Ramadan makes an appropriate ground for shunning immoralities. A cursory look at Muslim societies in Ramadan shows that there is a public tendency toward doing certain acts and refraining from others. Muslims in this month are inclined more than ever to help the needy and the poor. Many of them try to solve financial problems of orphans. Indeed, fasting strengthens the sense of sympathy with those people who are in problem and need in one way or another. It makes us heedful of the deprived strata. Although for the second consecutive year, people avoid gatherings and adhere to health protocols like social distancing, the hearts of people has come closer to each other. Everyone tries to have a share in assisting others. A person who wants to travel, if he leaves his city after the azan or call for prayer of midday ritual obligatory prayer, his fast is correct. But if he leaves the city before the azan, provided that he goes as far as 22.5 kilometers away, his fast is nullified. This is called religious distance. So he should break his fast and he can compensate for this day later on. Thus, if he travels a shorter distance, his fast is correct. The distance is reckoned from the last building of the city. Well, dear listeners, we are approaching the final days of the blessed month of Ramadan. If you remember, we had said that the night of Qadr is the time of determination of all events of 1 year for every individual. It is the night when the fate of the world and human community is determined. That's why some of the great ulama used to keep vigil all of the nights of the year in order to achieve the bounties and blessings of this unmatched night. If you recall, it was said that the eve of the 27th of Ramadan is considered by some ulama, especially Sunni brothers, as the night of Qadr. Interestingly, the supplication for the 27th day of Ramadan reads, O God, grant me on this day the virtue of the night of Qadr, and turn my affairs in it from hardship to ease, and accept my excuses, and remove from me sins and loads of evil deeds. O kind to his righteous servants. Late Ayatollah Ahmad Mojtahedi Tehrani briefly explained this supplication, saying, according to the first part of this supplication, some people believe that perhaps the eve of the 27th of Ramadan is the night of Qadr. Shias believe that most probably the 23rd is the night of Qadr, while the Sunni brothers believe it is the 27th. In the second part, we ask God to change our hardships to ease, and then we go to God and apologize for what we have done. If a child apologizes before his father, the father will be kind to him. This is while God is much kinder than parents, and we surely forgive. Now let us recite together the special supplication of this night. O expander of the shade, while you would fix it if you want it, and made the sun as its cause, then captured it easily. O owner of generosity and nobility and grandeur and bounties, there is no God except you, knower of the hidden and the manifest, the compassionate, the merciful. There is no God except you. O All Holy, O All Benign, O Securer, O All Conserver, O Almighty, O All Compeller, O All Magnanimous, O God, O Creator, O Maker, O Shaper, O God, O God, O God. The best names, the loftiest parables, and grandeur and bounties belong to you. I ask you to bless Muhammad and his progeny and place my name on this night among the successful, and my spirit with the martyrs, and my good deed at the highest point of paradise, and my evil deeds forgiven. And I plead to you to grant me certitude which accompanies with my heart and faith, which takes doubt away from me, and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude and enthusiasm toward you, and returning to you and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them.
The Palestinian cause has always been a core pillar of the Arab and Muslim homeland, the Ummah, as well as an important religious issue. Palestine's capital, Jerusalem, is home to the three major monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And of course, the Palestinian issue is also an issue of anti-imperialism. Israel was created in the wake of a mandate under the British Empire, and the Zionist ideology consists of dispossessing Palestinians of their homes and giving them to Jewish settlers from Europe and elsewhere. Let's take a look at 73 years of Israeli occupation in Palestine and international support for the Palestinian struggle.
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
A In 1916, during World War I, the British and French empires carved up the Middle East and divided it between themselves under the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement, named after Sykes, a British diplomat, and Picot, a French diplomat. During that time, the British had used the Arab tribes to organize an Arab revolt, rising up against the Ottoman Empire and defeating them with promises of independence for the Arabs. But these promises of an Arab homeland were short-lived and instead replaced with more colonial rule once again. In 1917, the British government issued a public statement saying that it would create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Shortly after, following the end of World War I, Palestine became a mandate under British rule from 1923 to 1948. In 1947, the United Nations came up with a partition plan which would divide Palestine in one half for the Arabs, one half for the Jews, and the Holy City of Jerusalem as a separate international entity. When the United Nations officially adopted the partition plan, 33 nations voted in favor, 13 against, and 10 abstained. The Palestinians and Arabs vehemently rejected this plan, which was seen as just another colonial partitioning, but this time for different settlers. After the British mandate was up in May 1948 and the Israelis declared their so-called independence on the last day, the other Arab countries declared war in support of Palestine, among them Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. This war resulted in a defeat for the Palestinians and Arabs and is known in Arabic as the Nakba, the catastrophe or cataclysm. Palestinians were robbed of their homeland, their independence, and their right to self-determination. This was followed by destruction of homes, villages, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Millions of Palestinians were forced to flee in a mass exodus, seeking refuge in neighboring countries like Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. Millions more were displaced and scattered internally inside Palestine, becoming refugees and stateless on their own land. And to this day, Palestine is not recognized as a state by the United Nations, despite the fact that Israel is, even though Israel is sitting on Palestinian land, occupying the Palestinian people, and made up of settlers who come from around the world and are not indigenous to Palestine. 1948 was not the only attempt by the Arabs to liberate Palestine. They tried many more times throughout the 20th century, again in 1967, 1973, and have supported the various Palestinian resistance and liberation groups throughout the years. Although there have been several wars and attempts to liberate Palestine, Arab support for the Palestinian cause has varied greatly through these many decades. Some consider the Arab support to be invaluable in keeping the Palestinian cause alive and sustaining the resistance. However, others feel that Arab countries' support has not always been unwavering, and in some cases, even blunted parts of the Palestinian resistance in order to protect their own interests, which is seen as being selfish and not in the interest of Palestine. The 1950s and 1960s marked the peak of Arab nationalism. In a period of decolonization or supposed decolonization, many Arab countries sought to unite with each other, and leaders like Egyptian President Abdel Nasser were revered all across the Arab world. The idea of Arab unity or pan-Arabism even resulted in Syria and Egypt forming one country called the United Arab Republic from 1958 until 1971. Egypt even kept this name for several years, and Syria still has the same flag to this day. However, at the height of all this, the war in June of 1967 marked the first great defeat for the Arab world. The Six-Day War resulted in a crushing, resounding military defeat. In a period of just 6 days, the Arabs could do nothing to liberate Palestine and in fact lost even more territory than they had begun with. As a result, Israel captured the Golan Heights from Syria, the Sinai Peninsula and Gaza Strip from Egypt, the West Bank and Jerusalem from Jordan. It was a soul-crushing and humiliating defeat that resulted in the fracture of Arab nationalism, in Nasser's resignation, and showed that the Arabs lacked unity. If the Arabs were too divided to even defend their own land, how could they possibly free Palestine and the holy city of Jerusalem? And since then, Israel has continued to illegally occupy the vast majority of these territories in violation of international law. So far, Israel has only given back the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, but still illegally occupies everything else. There have been multiple United Nations resolutions demanding that Israel withdraw from these lands and recognizing them as not Israeli. United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which was passed in November of 1967, clearly it demands the withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. However, to this day, 53 years later, Israel still refuses to do so. The UN and the international community have always recognized Jerusalem as a separate territory, or corpus separatum. This is specifically outlined in UN Security Council Resolution 181, which was adopted in 1947. A further resolution, 252, which was passed in 1968, urges Israel to refrain from unifying Jerusalem, which is essentially akin to annexation. In July of 1980, Israel violated these resolutions and passed a so-called Basic Law, or Jerusalem Law, through which it illegally annexed East Jerusalem and declared the Holy City its capital. The UN Security Council passed a further two resolutions in 1980, resolutions 476 and 478, calling on Israel to desist from altering the character and the status of the Holy City through legislative and administrative measures and censoring Israel's Jerusalem Law. A year later, in December 1981, Israel proceeded to illegally annex the occupied Syrian Golan Heights in violation of Resolution 242 yet again. Israel has categorically refused to abide by any of these UN Security Council resolutions. At this point, it's perhaps easier to count the number of resolutions that Israel has abided by than the ones that it hasn't. At this point, especially after the defeats of 48, 67, and 73, Arab nationalism and support for the Palestinian cause had significantly declined, and Israel now had received not just the full political backing of the West, but also its military backing through NATO, along with various forms of aid and military assistance from the United States and its allies. Throughout the years, one need only look at the map to see how much land Palestinians have lost through one form or another to Israel. And the more land the Palestinians lose, the more they are forgotten by the world and their supposed Arab brothers. Through colonization, war, and annexation, Israel has taken more and more Palestinian land, and even just last year, in the run-up to July of 2020, threatened to annex more of it, up to another 30% of the West Bank, in an annexation plan put forward by Netanyahu. This ultimately did not take place, but the Israelis definitely gained something else instead. The majority of Arab countries do not recognize Israel as a state. However, Israel has succeeded in turning some of them to its side through various measures. Egypt and Jordan were ultimately drawn into making peace and establishing ties with Israel through help, or some might say coercion, by the United States. Recently, even more Arab nations proceeded to recognize Israel and establish ties with the Zionist regime, after then U.S. President Donald Trump pushed through the Abraham Accords in 2020. With the Abraham Accords, through this agreement, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates opened embassies and economic relations with the Israelis. It had been already known for a few years that some of these Arab kingdoms had ties with the Israelis, but now this was finally out in the open and their cards on the table. There are still other Arab countries who are suspected of engaging with the Israelis, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, although they've yet to openly normalize relations with the Zionist regime, but it's rumored they will in the near future. Since Israel is a settler colonialist project, it deeply wants to be recognized as a real country. This is something that the Israelis crave very much. Perhaps one of the only valuable cards that Arab countries still hold is their refusal to recognize Israel. This is the only political leverage that they have, since virtually none exists militarily or economically. More importantly, perhaps, it is a moral imperative not to do this. How can these Arab countries recognize an Israeli state on Palestinian land when the Palestinians do not even have a state on Palestinian land? This is not only leverage, this is not only about leverage, but about common sense and solidarity. And nevertheless, when Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan recognized Israel, they threw away that leverage. When Iran had its Islamic Revolution in 1979, this was not just a rejection of imperialism, beginning with the ouster of the Shah, a puppet installed by Britain and the United States for access to Iran's oil, but also the beginning of a new source of support for the Palestinian resistance. Where the Arabs had failed, perhaps Iran had stepped in. One of the core pillars of Iran's Islamic Revolution has been the liberation of Palestine. Under the Shah, Iran had established ties with the Zionist occupation because the Shah was doing the bidding of the West. However, in 1979, Iran severed ties with the Israelis and handed over Israel's embassy in Tehran to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Every year since, Iran celebrates Quds Day, or Jerusalem Day, as a show of solidarity with Palestinians and for the liberation of the holy city of Jerusalem. This is not just celebrated in Iran, but also internationally with various marches of solidarity in other countries and cities across the world. Israel has, of course, dubbed the celebration anti-Semitic, which is what it says about any criticism of Israel, and now the holiday has actually even been banned in Germany. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Dr. Daniel Yegich, writer and researcher based in Lebanon. Thank you for taking the time, Daniel. It is great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So, Daniel, I want to go back a bit in time, you know, in terms of Arab support for the Palestinian cause. You know, we start in 1948 with Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt. They all marched to war in the name of Palestine. But, you know, ever since, among each one of them, their support varies and changes over the years. And I was wondering if you could maybe break down why this happened and why you had a kind of split in factions and in terms of, you know, support from the Arab countries towards the Palestinian cause.
It's a very important question. And yeah, as we can see today, if we start looking at the situation from today's perspective, several Arab countries have officially announced the normalization with the Zionist regime. And of course, this is a result of decades of an increased cooperation between several Arab regimes and the Zionist entity. And of course, it has to do with Israel throughout the last 23 years becoming quite a strong player in this region, obviously through it being supported by the United States and numerous most Western countries to an extent that allows Israel to expand its expansionist and settler colonialist hegemony that it has in the region. And of course, numerous Arab countries, particularly those that have quite recently announced their normalization with Israel, are as well regimes that are not necessarily democratic countries, but unelected dictatorships that work in accordance with the United States and its allies, which makes them natural allies of the Zionist entity as well. And at the same time, of course, within the so-called Arab world, several countries have never had any conflict with Israel, whereas others, such as, I mean, beyond Palestine, of course, Lebanon, and Syria are until this day affected by, to some extent, daily invasions by Israel. And look at, you know, the situation in Lebanon, where Israel is invading the Lebanese, Lebanese airspace several times a day. So this is, there have been different experiences and different orientations towards the Zionist regime that range from opposition to complete acceptance of the Zionist settler colonial project.
Was there a split in terms of support in regard to strategy? Because, you know, some countries, perhaps Egypt, didn't want to get drawn into a war with Israel again, and so they hindered the Palestinian resistance. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the countries have been under pressure. If you look at, you know, Egypt or Jordan, who have officially signed peace treaties, all of this was also based to some extent to keep themselves safe and secure within their own borders. And then to that extent, Palestinians have oftentimes been an obstacle for these regimes in order to enforce their own political, economic goals. And of course, I guess the United States plays a very particular role there as well, which also puts pressure on its allies to move towards closer ties with the Zionist regime.
I recall a famous speech from the Syrian defense minister, Mustafa Atlas, where he's angry at Arafat for going to the White House, for engaging with the Israelis. And it's actually interesting because in that speech, he actually doesn't mention the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. He speaks specifically about Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. Why is that? Why does Jerusalem, Al-Quds, hold so much importance? I mean, obviously, it's a holy city, but, you know, to all the parties who support the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because Jerusalem, I think, is at least symbolic or representative of the sole settler colonial inscription and indigenous erasure. This week there have been several new incidents of violence, of settler violence, of Israelis trying to expel Palestinians from their homes. There's a constant recreation of violence on a territory that is officially occupied under international law. And of course, it has a historic significance being the declared capital of Palestine and plays a particular role in numerous religions. which is why I think it has symbolically as well as politically quite a strong importance, but it's also a declared goal. It has always been the goal of the Zionist settler movement to get to Jerusalem and to convert it into their city, or what they call as unification of Jerusalem. So that's why it is also central in ideas of decolonization and liberation of Palestine.
Yeah, you mentioned the recent violence that's taking place there in Jerusalem, these pogroms, you know, these angry mobs chanting death to Arabs, and the Israeli border police, they're essentially just letting them do it. I mean, what is the current state of Palestinian support from their neighbors and the international community? Because as far as I can see, it's non-existent, right? And this is just happening in broad daylight, and no one says anything.
Absolutely. We're living in time for social media where, I guess, on a daily basis, there are new videos and audio, visual evidence of Israel's crimes, of Palestinians being killed live on camera, evicted from their homes. And the international community has remained either silent to some extent, but at the same time has also, throughout the last decade, reframed the Palestinian cause from a struggle, a colonized people's struggle for liberation, into a sort of diplomatic conflict between two equal sides. This is something, I guess, that we also see in the media coverage also of the latest events in Jerusalem, where oftentimes Christian is presented as an alleged fight between Jews and Arabs, between Palestinians and Israelis, and so on, whereas effectively it is, of course, a very genocidal settler colonial movement, and language plays a very particular role in that. And we see that even, as you mentioned, the Arab regimes that have normalized their ties with Israel as well aren't paying as much attention to that as they might have done decades ago, but the violence has become quite normalized. And even though there are numerous new eruptions of violence, as they have been referred to in the media recently, they are part and parcel of a structure, because Zionism as a settler colonial movement is genocidal in its structure and continues to kill Palestinians and to destroy Palestine, whereas, again, the international community isn't really intervening, but rather choosing euphemisms and synonyms for ways in which they can maybe reduce, at least linguistically, these genocidal dimensions of Israel's violence.
I want to talk a little bit about Quds Day or Jerusalem Day. You know, this is something that has been celebrated by Iran to show solidarity with Palestine since their Islamic Revolution. And I wanted to ask if you can maybe expand on that, and also how Iran, you know, being the only non-Arab country in the region, how it's still been a huge supporter of Palestine in general from, you know, 1979 all the way until now.
Yeah, Iran has shown and continues to show strong support for the Palestinian resistance, both, of course, through solidarity, ideology, as well as, I guess, economically and financially. And there it is, Iran's support for the Palestinian cause has also been an issue for several Arab regimes that have maybe gained more of a distance towards the Palestinian cause as such, but is also used by the Zionist regime in their propaganda, pretty much as in, I mean, there's this continuous repetition of Orientalist tropes that the Zionist regime has employed, and whereas it was previously the PLO, in particular, or Hamas, it is today oftentimes Iran that is a direct target of the Zionist regime, being accused of anything that has to do with Palestinian resistance efforts. So to that extent, Iran, of course, is a non-Arab country, plays a major role in the continuity of Palestinian resistance efforts and efforts of liberation against the Zionist regime.
Would you say the support that comes from Iran, Syria, Lebanon, the support they give to Palestine, that it's actually one of the main reasons the West targets them for regime change?
Yeah, so of course there is solidarity among the population in these countries, but also beyond in the broader region with Palestine. At the same time, of course, Lebanon and Syria and Iran themselves are targeted by the Zionist regime, because Israel's violence has never been restricted to historical Palestine. I think this plays a major role and makes a difference between these countries and other countries.